Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. All right, well, welcome back. And it is now or never. And don't forget that debt is a fraud. And don't forget, learn, pray, and act. So, we got Tammy with us, and we want to dive into content because we're actually running out of time because it's the week of Thanksgiving. So, anyway, so welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
And we just wrapped up the Virginia resolutions. And now we're going to go into the responses to these two resolutions. Jefferson or the Kentucky resolutions went out, and a month or so later, Virginia replied in kind and called upon all. Said, "We're on board. We're with you. All the rest of the states, please get on board with us." And not one state got on board because they were that corrupted. And so I'm just going to lay this out here. We know that the states are corrupted, folks. All we have to do is start holding them accountable, and then they have no wiggle room. Because when they know they're being held accountable, they're there to do a specific job to save this nation. We can do this. Now, it takes a movement. All you need to do is get the movement started in your county, and you will be blown away. Now, you can use the party to initiate this, but the party, you know, once the party initiates, the party has to recognize that if you have parties, there's always going to be an opposition party. If your party stands for compliance to the Constitution and demands full compliance to the Constitution, what party would actually legitimately be able to oppose that? That's a question for you. Do you got an idea on what party that would be? The party that would oppose constitutional compliance? That would be, this is not a trick question. That would be the party that actually would tell you these are the people we need to remove from America. Because every citizen is obligated to support that Constitution, whether you like it or not. There's a process. If you think it needs to be changed, there's a process of changing the Constitution in whatever fashion you want to change it. Where if you want to invoke a democracy, then you've got to go. If you want to invoke, you know, some other form of government, you want the government to do things it's not empowered to do, you got to go. And so it's really that simple. We actually thought that, you know, it's okay to have opposing ideas when it comes to the state level, the county level, but when it comes to the U.S. Constitution, there is no opposing ideas. The only reason, again, the only reason that in the initial congressional sessions that they started playing around with things that were unconstitutional is because they never definitized the Constitution. Now, this is an interesting word. Definitized or definitizing or the act to definitize is to actually make it a complete and final product. In other words, a compendious summation of what it is. It's kind of like canonizing a final product of the Bible. You know, you've compiled, and this is the final, this is the Bible. We never definitized the Constitution because they didn't have the, I'll just say, one thing they had was they had faith and trust in each other, and that was misplaced. Because even Madison knew, back in those days, he knew that they couldn't do those types of things because in Federalist Paper 10, Madison said this: if men were angels, no government would be necessary. Because in those days, they all recognized that men weren't angels. So he says, if angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. Mm-hmm. A dependence on the people is, no doubt, the primary control on the government. But experience has taught mankind the necessity of auxiliary precautions. In other words, checks and balances, keeping, you know, each other in check, using petitions. Had they definitized the Constitution, it would have been a lot harder. That would have been an extra auxiliary precaution to make it harder, if not impossible, for men to do bad things in governing men. And what I mean by this is definitizing the Constitution is a simple concept. What you do is you go through the ratification debates and you go through the Constitution. And when it talks about legislative powers vested in Congress only, then you actually go through the ratification debates and I highlight how that was defined. How did they define it in Pennsylvania? You know, clearly that means that only Congress could create law. So then you ask yourself, well, can the court create law? Can they make a ruling that becomes law?
No.
Can a president write an executive order that can be law?
No.
How about become law? No. And so there you go. So when you actually lay out how each of these things were defined, then it makes it hard for somebody to come up with the conclusion, well, then the Supreme Court can make law. No, or we interpret that the Supreme Court, through their rulings, can make law. No, right.
All of these executive orders that Biden and Trump makes, are any of them lawful?
There is no lawful law that has ever come from the president or the court.
Okay, in so other his words, executive orders aren't coming from, there's already a law established and I'm just executing it.
Okay.
Is there any of that?
So if there is a law that's been written by Congress, and here's the hard part. Has the law been made in pursuant to the Constitution? I'll give you a good example. We saw that Congress passed the law, the Alien and Sedition Acts. Had Adams not signed that and he vetoed it, and then they overpowered his veto. In other words, they came because if John Adams did the right thing, and you know, I felt the earth move a little bit. He just rolled in his grave. He doesn't like criticism. But if John Adams did the right thing and he actually vetoed that bill, and Congress, with 2/3 of both houses, overcame that veto, now he would have to enforce an unconstitutional bill. Had we actually gone down this path, and had we had a vigilant president, then I think the president would have gone straight into the Supreme Court and go, show me how this bill is constitutional. And basically, had he done the argument that Thomas Jefferson laid out, then I truly see this, you know, this layout as, we need to amend the Constitution to ensure that even if Congress and the president allow a law that is not in pursuant to the Constitution to be passed, the states need to, or they needed to come up with something to actually say, you can't apply this to us. This would have been another auxiliary precaution where maybe the court. But what happens when all three branches of the federal government decide to apply unconstitutionally a law to the states?
We're screwed.
Well, so no. This is why we're going through these documents, because we now understand that the states have to step up. And when we get through this, because what we're going to get through today is how Thomas Jefferson responded to all of these states failing to do what had to be done. You know, you would think that we would be screwed, as you say, because Congress and the government and the state governments are all okay with fleecing America, with basically applying tyrannical laws upon the people. The power still rests in the people to actually take their government back. And that mechanism is the ultimate check in the Constitution. That is the ultimate check. Even though they have deviated and they're no longer using we the people to execute the laws of the Union, they have actually created their own standing armies. I mean, one would think that this it's insurmountable. But it's actually very simple. When you take back your counties and you take back your states, then it is, you know, next thing you know, how easy it will be to take back the federal government. But we have to, we cannot allow any further. Remember what Madison said in his resolutions the other day, right? When he said any infraction needs to be opposed. Any infraction. So when you sit down and you lay out a petition to your county, supervisors, commissioners, whatever you call them, legislators, when you stand in front of your county legislators and they say, well, why should I do this? Then you point to Madison and say, look, it is your responsibility to keep our state government in check. And you cannot allow any infraction. Madison clearly states this. You must oppose any infraction. If they're failing to hold the federal government accountable, then it's your job because they're your child. You created them. You, the counties, created the state and that constitution. Just like the states and the legislatures created that constitution, what we call the federal constitution. So Jefferson is basically, I think ultimately realized that we're at this point that the states were so corrupt that it would take a long, hard row to hoe to actually do what we have to do. But he looked in the mirror and he said, hey, Mr. Madison, James, go look in the mirror. What do you see? And I said, well, I just see myself. And I go, yeah, I see the father of the Constitution. I see the author of the Declaration of Independence. We're superstars. And we actually, and America loves us. And we actually can, overcome this in this upcoming political campaign. So literally, Madison's report, which is following this, because if you scroll down to the day on the Kentucky Resolutions of 1799, you'll notice that this was sent out and approved by the Kentucky legislature December 3rd, 1799. Madison does his in 1800, and that happens to be the election year, the year that they choose a new president and they actually select the new session of Congress. And there's a lot of seats that are going up for grabs in the state. And this is literally a coup. They basically throw off those in control of many of the states as well as the federal government to, enough people get displaced. Enough of the big government federalists get displaced in this upcoming year. And how do they do that? Because when you really think about what happened by communicating out to these states, this was an alarm. And when members, because these states may have unanimously rejected these other two states. In other words, all the state legislatures, but each state was not unanimous within itself. In other words, there were probably more people sitting there aghast that the state legislature actually was going down this path. And so they went out and they said, you know what just happened? There was this opposition from Kentucky and Virginia about, these laws, and nobody's doing anything in this state. So in other words, they sounded the alarm, and throughout all of the states, good people arose that were in the state legislature to lead a charge to replace these bad players. They didn't get rid of everybody at first. it took a little while for the Federalists to be completely obsolete. And when you look at the election in, I think it was 1822, James Monroe, who was a Republican, was elected almost unanimously. There was only one elector that did not vote for him. He didn't vote. In other words, it was going to be a unanimous selection for the Republican president in 1822. That's how many Federalists got displaced and how the shifting of American politics went. But I think at this point in time, they were so ensconced in party factions, you know, big government, little government, and so forth, that things were about to shift again. And that's exactly what happened, because John Quincy Adams became president, and all of a sudden the big government people came out. And John Quincy Adams' focus was slavery. And that's what kind of created this shift, because by this point in time, they had institutionalized, I should say, oppression and or racism within laws. This is when, by the 1820s, most every state had laws against blacks voting. They actually started creating laws to keep women from voting as well, that you had to be a male, white male. That's when it became specific, because it was kind of generic that you had to be a property owner. And many states allowed blacks. Prior to 1800, many blacks, freeman blacks, were voting. And actually some women property holders were voting, because after the Revolutionary War, there were plenty of widows that had property. And the states needed the money. And if a widow wanted to pay a poll tax to vote, they let that happen. Many of the states, yeah, I should say, let that happen, because are they going to turn down the money?
Yeah.
But things change. And over time, they realized that, you know, there weren't so many widows, that they basically said, no, we're not allowing you to vote anymore, and we're not letting you get involved in this stuff anymore. And so America started taking this oppressive turn. And by the 1820s, we became so polarized regarding racism, or I should say regarding slavery and these bad paradigms, John Quincy Adams, when he lost his presidential election for the second term, because everybody thought that he was going to bring forth, you know, the emancipation or something like that, when actually that was impossible to do. And I just realized I went down a rat hole, because James Monroe actually galvanized slavery. Basically, what happened with the Missouri Compromise basically made it a necessity that we had to go into the Civil War. And so when John Quincy Adams lost his seat, he spent the rest of his life as a senator in the U.S. Senate. Tell me any president that has ever gone back into the Senate or gone back to, right. So as a president that was so adamantly strong in trying to stop slavery, and he got unseated, he spent the rest of his life and career in the Senate trying to fight slavery. So,
wow.
So obviously there was this real polarization that was really occurring, and it became stronger and stronger as the North became more abolitionist, and the South, you got to remember that the South was still looking over their shoulder, because they couldn't create large populations, because they couldn't create factories and those types of things. They needed the land to produce their, you know, their crops. And that's why they had to have slavery. Anyway, long story short, bottom line is the Kentucky Resolutions was the realization for Thomas Jefferson and then ultimately Madison. We don't know what the conversation was, but they decided to commit the coup to get the nation back on track. But nobody was around in 1820s to get the nation back on track. Nobody has been around since these two to get the nation back on track. We have yet to have, and no President Donald J. Trump has not and is not so far giving any sign that he's going to get this nation back on track. Back on track and in the framework of the Constitution. Now, this is one of the reasons why on Mondays and Fridays, I try to give you points of things that have to happen if we're going to get this nation back on track. You know, it'd be nice to see 50% of these things happen. But why can't we have a constitutional president? I'm not running for president. I'm not going to run for president. And there's reasons for that. I mean, I would become president if people just said, that's it, we want GR to be president. But that's not going to happen. You have to actually want a constitutional president. You basically have to start developing and nurturing that president. Just like you have to develop and nurture all of your public servants to actually support the Constitution. If you want your liberties, if you want your king, then the next king's around the corner.
Yeah, if I were president, that would be my first priority, is getting an advisor who is a constitutional.
You'd think so. You'd think so, because then you'd actually have maybe a scintilla of protection from the courts and everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And you know, so I've already covered these key issues, but I'll continue to do that all the way up to probably the inauguration, because there's that many things that need to be done. That many things that need to be brought to the, you know, to the light of day, so that everybody sees, oh, wow, I already covered, you know, a few key issues, but we're moving forward. Let's get into the Kentucky Resolutions of 1799 regarding the Alien Sedition Acts. So go ahead and read the first resolution. We got 2.5 minutes.
The representatives of the good people of this Commonwealth and General Assembly convened, having maturely considered the answers of sundry states in the Union to their resolutions passed at the last session, respecting certain unconstitutional laws of Congress, commonly called the Alien and Sedition Acts, would be faithless indeed to themselves and to those they represent, were they silently to acquiesce in principles and doctrines attempted to be maintained in all those answers that of Virginia only accepted.
Okay, so basically what he tried to tell you in their language is that everybody rejected it except for Virginia. And you don't get that out of this, but bottom line is everybody acquiesced in those principles and doctrines attempted to be maintained in all those answers that of Virginia only accepted. In other words, they didn't care about maintaining the Constitution. Only Virginia did. So, and I know it kind of just, why did he speak it that way? Because that's how they speaketh.
Yeah.
Okay, so go ahead and read the last line, then we'll prep for the next one.
Again,
go ahead.
Enter the field of argument and attempt more fully or forcibly to expose the unconstitutionality of those obnoxious laws would, it as apprehended, be as unnecessary as unavailing.
Okay, so still difficult, but bottom line, he wasn't happy with all of these other states coming back and actually saying, we're not the problem, you are. They're not the problem, you are. And so this is where he really lays out what happened and how he really feels about it. Because, you know, Thomas Jefferson did the right thing. And he called upon the leaders of the other states to do the right thing. Madison taught the Virginia legislature in person. He was there. And he basically held their hand in helping them understand why this was the right thing to do. So after they did this, and then all of a sudden they got back these replies, we don't know, we haven't seen yet, and we're going to go into break right now. So when we come back, we're going to actually read the second resolution. But in the second resolution, he basically identifies what and how they received that answer from the other states regarding their resolutions going to them. In other words, were they warmly received? Were they, you know, we find some problems. You didn't cross your T's. You didn't dot your I's. You know, how did they respond? And he actually tells you what and how they responded to them. And so, like I said, we're going into a break. So we'll be right back and dive right back into Resolution 2. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so let's find out, you know, what kind of responses did they receive? Because, you know, I could tell you what they said, but actually Thomas Jefferson kind of lays it out here. So go ahead. And what's interesting is I'm going to kind of give it away a little bit. Because he starts off with, we cannot, however, but lament. Now, lament's not a good thing, right?
No.
Okay. So go ahead and expand on that.
We cannot, however, but lament that in the discussion of those interesting subjects by sundry of the legislatures of our sister states, unfounded suggestions and uncandid insinuations, derogatory of the true character and principles of the good people of this commonwealth, have been substituted in place of fair reasoning and sound argument.
Wow. So let's stop right there. He basically laid it out that unfounded suggestions, uncandid insinuations, derogatory of the true character and principle of the good people of this commonwealth. In other words, they were slinging insults at him big time. They were basically saying, probably, and I'm just going to guess, you know, what's the matter with you folks in Kentucky? You know, have you been inbreeding too much? That kind of stuff, right? I mean, they're basically insulting, but I honestly see that they were calling them treasonous. That type of uncandid, you know, hyperbole that was literally went way too far. It was basically, hey, cool your jets kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in other words, there had to have been some real insults that they had to suffer in those comments. But go ahead.
Our opinions of those alarming measures of the general government, together with our reasons for those opinions, were detailed with decency and with temper and submitted to the discussion and judgment of our fellow citizens throughout the Union.
Okay, so he's basically saying that what we basically put in these resolutions had detail that was actually in a decent temper. In other words, he was just basically saying these things are unconstitutional. These violate this. We need to get together because if not, we're going to go down this path of, and actually Madison said, as we ended that, basically, if you remember in the Virginia resolutions of the last, you know, yesterday, actually last week, I'm sorry. So when we look at what he says at best a monarchy, or at least at best a mixed monarchy, right? And I've kind of went down the path that I believe that was more of an oligarchy that he was foreseeing, that hindsight being 2020, we ended up getting, I should say, a mixed monarchy. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, here he's basically saying, we actually spelled this thing out and we gave you the details.
We were nice about it.
And, you know, and you're not proving us wrong. I think that's the one thing he really didn't say. He didn't poke him back in the eye and say, hold on here. You know, you need to cite how these things are not violating the Constitution. In other words, they allowed themselves to deal with, you know, opinions instead of facts. Because when you look at what Thomas Jefferson sent out, there was maybe some hard spins on how these facts, you know, would impact the future of America. And he was right. But still, I don't believe that these other states came back citing, are you kidding me? That doesn't violate the First Amendment. That doesn't violate this part of the Constitution. They didn't do that. They only slinged insults and made, you know, uncandid insinuations. So go ahead and read the last part.
Whether the decency and temper have been observed in the answers of the most of those states who have denied or attempted to obviate the great truths contained in those resolutions, we have now only to submit to a candid world.
Yeah, keep faithful, going. Yeah, go ahead.
Faithful to the true principles of the federal union, unconscious of any designs to disturb the harmony of that union, and anxious only to escape the fangs of despotism, the good people of this commonwealth are, regardless of censure or
Calumination. Okay, so basically he's saying that, you know, you guys obviated. In other words, they basically bypassed. They failed to dive into. So this actually supports what I was saying. You know, knowing what he was going to say, I guess I should probably got ahead of myself. But obviously, they did everything but address the facts. And so he went down this path of saying, you know, we had no design, says unconscious of any design. They had no design to disturb the harmony of the union. Remember, it's about the union. It's not about this little creature called the federal government. It's about the states being together and working together so that they can enjoy this, the tranquility underneath this little umbrella of the union called the Constitution. So go ahead and let's dive into the third resolution.
Okay. Least, however, the silence of this commonwealth should be construed into an acquiescence in the doctrines and principles advanced and attempted to be maintained by the said answers, or least those of our fellow citizens throughout the Union, who so wildly differ from us on those important subjects, should be deluded by the expectation that we shall be deterred from what we conceive our duty, or shrink from the principles contained in those resolutions.
Contained in those resolutions, therefore, right?
Therefore,
okay.
Yeah.
So what he's saying here is, however, the silence of this commonwealth should be construed into acquiescing. In other words, if you think that because we're not going to say anything, or because we're not going to nullify and leave, in other words, we're going to stay in this union, and I'm again kind of spoiling it, but because don't think that we're on board with these principles. We are on board with the original principles of this union. And so however you think it's going to go, you know, here are our final resolutions based on your responses to us. The initial resolutions still stood, but here is the final resolutions. Go ahead. Now, this is paragraph four, folks.
Yes.
And as a matter of fact, so Tammy, right, therefore, resolved. Yes. Let's go ahead and let's take it like a sentence at a time, or actually a major, because I think this ends, if you notice that paragraph three was one sentence.
Yeah.
So let's take it to, you know, like colons to semicolons and so forth, so that we can dissect what he's saying. Go ahead.
Resolved that this commonwealth considers the federal union upon the terms and for the purposes specified in the late compact as conducive to the liberty and happiness of the several states.
Okay, so they see the Constitution as the fountain of liberty and happiness. Abiding by that Constitution is what delivers that. It's conducive to liberty and happiness. Go ahead.
That it does now unequivocally declare its attachment to the Union and to that compact agreeable to its obvious and real intention, and will be among the last to seek its dissolution.
Okay, so we're committed. We're unequivocally declare our attachment to the Union. In other words, we're here with you, and that we are agreeable, you know, in these basic intentions of maintaining the union, and we'll be the last state to seek dissolution. In other words, the dissolving of the union. Okay? Because apparently some of those insinuations where you're just trying to destroy the union so you could have, you know, you could be yourself, be an independent state and do whatever you want to do. You know, let's look at Kentucky. Kentucky didn't have a major water thoroughfare. They were dependent on Virginia. They were, you know, they were dependent on the union for access to world markets and so forth. They were kind of isolated. If they wanted to actually nullify and break away from the union, how would they get their commerce to around the world? They understood that they needed to be a part of the union, just like all of them needed to be a part of the union, or they would be vulnerable to the harassments and the manipulations of the other governments of the world. Anyway, go ahead and take up the next one.
That if those who administer the general government be permitted to transgress the limits fixed by that compact by a total disregard to the special delegations of power therein contained, annihilation of the state governments and the erection upon their ruins of a general consolidated government will be the inevitable consequence.
Okay, so those who administer the general government, that's the federal government, folks. Those who are in the federal government, the president, Congress, and the Supreme Court, if they are permitted to transgress the limits fixed, in other words, these hard limits that are in that Constitution, with disregard, and they start delegating special powers that, you know, are not within that, and they're basically annihilation, because he's saying that if we allow them to do this, they're going down the path of annihilating the state governments and erecting upon the ruins of the state government a federal government that is consolidated. They're creating a federation, assuming all powers, will be the inevitable consequence. So, in other words, he's saying that they were a confederation. All powers that were not delegated, very limited powers. If you look up the difference between a confederation and a federation has most all powers. A confederation, where the general government is created, it has very limited and defined powers. The federal government in a federation has almost all of the powers. The states in a federal or a federation, the states in a federation are basically administrative functioning states. They have very little power. They just basically execute the laws that come from the federation. So he's laying this all out. This is the framework, and this is the form of the government that we have, and this is what's going to end up happening. So go ahead with the next one.
That the principle and construction contended for by sundry of the state legislatures, that the general government is the exclusive judge of the extent of the powers delegated to it, stop nothing short of despotism, since the discretion of those who administer the government and not the Constitution would be the measure of their powers.
Okay, so we went past the semicolon, but that's okay. That the principle and construction contended by all of these other state legislatures that basically insulted us, that this federal government is going to be the exclusive judge of the powers that they believe that's been delegated to it, then we're heading towards despotism, since it is their discretion, since the discretion of those who administer it's the federal government's discretion and not the Constitution that would measure their powers. Because, see, the Constitution is what gives them their powers. If we allow them to think that they can do whatever they want, then it's their discretion. So, yeah. This is what he then goes further on. Again, this is all one sentence, right? So, go ahead.
Yeah. That the several states who formed that instrument, being sovereign and independent, have the unquestionable right and judge of its infraction.
Okay, so there it is right here, that the states, the 13 original states, and all the states that joined the union, basically joined the union on the exact same principles, that they were sovereign and independent. that this concept that the federal government would actually be the judge of the infractions and the nullification, or hold on here, I think I missed that, that the several states who have formed that instrument, created the Constitution, being the sovereign and independent states, have the unquestionable right to judge its infractions. So, in other words, who has the right to judge these infractions? So he's addressing this little point that we didn't read, that the state said, hey, you guys are acting like you're the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court is the judge over these things. And this is, they wanted to get people to go into the court. And he says, no. It is the states that have the unquestionable right to judge of its infractions, and that a nullification by those sovereignties of all unauthorized acts done under the color, in other words, without the legitimacy, under the color, or the color of law, is laws that are not legitimate. So he's basically, go ahead.
Are you saying, because this is where I try to bring back, what do we do then? So you're saying that all the states need to get together and make a statement, make a whatever. What are they making that nullifies this?
So the only way a law can be nullified in the paradigm of nullification, the common understanding back in those days, the author of the law is the only authority that can nullify the law. However, when you have control, it's kind of like when your child kind of creates a rule for the home. You created that child. The home is yours. And the child creates a rule for the home, for the union, to say, you have to do these things. Then the owners of the home, the parents, the states in this case, have to look at that room or look at that law and say, you know what? We didn't create you to govern us in that way. As a matter of fact, if you look at, you know, how we created you and defined your powers, that's not within your power. In other words, it's not something that the child can take from one side, from the executive and the legislative, go over to the judiciary and say, I will allow it. I will allow myself to do what I want to do. Because
that's a good analysis.
Right. And if you empower a child to raise itself, if you've ever seen The Outer Limits, if you've ever seen Twilight Zone, and you actually have a child that has the ability and the power to seize control, you will actually see, you know, a very short-sighted, destructive monster. Right? I mean, there have been episodes where a child had thought control over, you know, over a person, and they could force that person to do anything and everything that they wanted to do. There's all different episodes that play out, and you'll see that the child, when they realize their power and start exerting the power, they only do what they want. And it's very short-sighted and it's very destructive. They, in some ways, they're self-destructive because a child lacks wisdom. Now, in this particular case, we have a very smart child. It's almost like this child is AI, and we've created an AI monster. But the reality is, it doesn't have any of these powers. We have to keep it in check.
But, so the states, who are the parents of the home, then get together and...
And they basically then say, they start taking back those powers to say, or actually, they get the child to cease. Now, we look at a child as a living entity. The federal government is not a living entity. It's a perpetual entity, but it is made up of who? Representatives, people. Right? The government is actually those people who are occupying seats. And those seats are the people in those seats are interchangeable. So it's kind of like you see, you know, you got the shell of a robot. You got the shell of this being, this entity. And all of the people in it are basically, you know, interchangeable. You don't have to, and that's what we see here. We actually see a federal government that has interchangeable people, and it is assumed powers, and it constantly works to gain more and more and more. And it works endlessly, like evil, working to obtain all and ultimately every power capable that it would be capable of having or that exists in the world. Because as Lord Acton stated, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're.
So I guess I'm still confused at what exactly.
Oh, okay.
Is needed.
Okay,
for them
so,
to do to take back. Like I understand.
So okay,
why.
So I've worked. Okay, so we you now understand that when we look at how this entity is operating, the majority of the people sitting in the seats are on board with the tyranny and the growth and the destruction of the union with, you know, with, I should say destruction of the union, consumption and centralizing powers over the union and so forth. So the majority of the people have to change. The only way you can actually, you know, depower or basically defang this entity is you have to change the paradigms over half of Congress. Because when you really look at this robot, the president may be a head, but it is not the heart and soul and the life of the government. Our representatives are. The court is not either. The court may be a weapon and a shield, but it is not the heart and soul of our government. Our representatives are. So when we change the mindset or the paradigms of over half of the Congress, now we have the ability to actually, it has the ability to do what it has to do. Because we have the power of replacing them. We have the
right,
power
so let's
to...
Let's just say that we have replaced them and we have...
Okay, so if you look
we've
at...
We've done
the,
all that,
right, if
then
you look,
what do they do?
Okay, so if you look at the Republic Review model, once we have enough states in control... That means that the states have control over those entities and beings that are sitting in those seats. If those entities and beings sitting in those seats say, we don't care what you want to do, I may represent you, but I'm not doing that. Now the state, under that constitution, has the authority to actually pull back that person by charging them and extraditing them. The Constitution in Article 4 allows the state to charge them and extradite them. And bottom line, because they can enforce the Constitution, bottom line, as they start pulling back all of these members of Congress that are refusing, and there'll likely be the Democrats from Texas, there'll likely be the Democrats from some of these red states, because there are Democrats that are getting elected in red states.
Mm-hmm.
Very few, but they still exist. And so as they get rid of those, then all of the seats within Congress will be 100% on board in supporting that Constitution. And they will know that if they fail to, they will too be equally jerked back to the state and banned from ever being a public servant again. Because everybody's going to see what's going to happen to these guys. And everybody's looking over their shoulder. I don't want that to happen to me. And I'm going to do what I need to do. So then the states will start sending directives. You will stand down the Department of Education, and in so doing, you will declare that we have no enumerated power to be involved in education whatsoever other than maintaining and training the militia. That is the mm-hmm. only responsibility they have in maintaining the training for the militia. That's it. And then they will get a directive that will stand down the Department of Housing, that they have no authority whatsoever to be involved in housing within the states. Then they'll get a directive that will actually stand down the Department of Energy, stand down the Department of Labor, and they will literally be directed to what they have to do. Eventually, we'll start replacing enough people of Congress, and this will grow to a point where I don't think the states will necessarily need to create the directives, but what we want to make sure, and I point this out in Republic Review, we don't want to actually shut down the Department of Education in a minute. What we have to do is we have to create a sunset. In other words, they're going to create the directive that the Department of Education will cease to be functioning, bringing on new contracts, doing anything and spending money other than the staffing. And what will end up happening is we'll capture all of the data, all of the emails that are in the servers for the Department of Education. All of these things, we'll just archive all of that stuff, everything that they've done, and then we'll slowly sell off the property, the buildings, dismantle it, or sell it, allow somebody else to buy it. And actually what may end up happening is D.C. may actually be depopulated. But over time, you have to do this over time so that the people in the Department of Education can get their, you know, get their opportunities to figure out what state they're going to go to try to help and hopefully try to improve the education at the state level if there's those opportunities. If not, they'll have to get a job doing something that's actually productive. But we don't want to basically give everybody a pink slip, you know, in D.C. all at once, because all that will do is that will create this sucking sound of, you know, hate, discontent, and, you know, all these people that won't have any money because they're not getting paid anymore. See my point? We can't we can't become this heartless, you know, I'll say firing, you know, entity, the guy that goes around fires everybody. We can't just do that. We have to give, let everybody know that, you know, you may think you've got a retirement, but that retirement isn't even legitimate.
Right.
You may think you have these benefits, and the states will actually have to be very understanding in dealing with these federal employees that are coming into their states. They may want to actually transition those that are commutable. In other words, if you're in the Department of Transportation, you should actually be able to find a decent job in, you know, within the states. Because it's, what are we going to abandon schools? Are we going to abandon education or abandon our highway system? Are we going to abandon, you know, housing? Are we, I mean, we're not abandoning these things. We're still going to live in houses. So those people in, that have usable, the bureaucrats, if you don't have a usable skill and you can't offer anything, then you may need to go back to school and maybe, you know, get a degree in YouTube directing or something, like the kids today. Or go back and live, you know, in your parents' garage or in the basement or what have you. Anyway, so does that make sense? That's, we'll actually, the states will actually start directing them to dismantle this, dismantle that, and clearly delineate. They will demand that they clearly delineate that they violated the Constitution in creating this, that they will never do this again unless there is an amendment from the states granting them this authority. We have to dismantle these things, and if the states decide to amend the Constitution, go, hold on here, we really want them to have this, then okay, but I have arguments to do the contrary, that we never want them to do anything over regarding domestic issues. Madison and Hamilton, they both agreed that they didn't want the federal government to be doing those types of domestic things. Now, Hamilton, after that, may have changed his opinion, but bottom line, we have ways of actually improving what we should be doing and how to do that, because we have technology now that they didn't have then. And so this is where we can actually make America sustainable for hundreds of thousands of years, where we can actually grow by, based on the wisdom we've obtained over the past 200 plus years. Anyway, that's it for today. We'll get back into this Kentucky Resolution 1799 in our next episode. I'm J.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.